I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer. I just wanted to let you know that this episode of Vermont Edition has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Of the three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch, Vermonters probably know less about the state's court system than the other two. Well, what are the major challenges facing Vermont's judiciary? And are there ways to improve the state's court system? Today on Vermont Edition, we'll look at these questions and more with our guest. Our guest is the Chief Justice of the Vermont Supreme Court, Paul Reiber. Justice Reiber, thanks very much for being on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, one thing I do need to mention is that we are not going to discuss the details regarding any specific decision. That's not the purpose of today's program. Paul Reiber practiced law in Rutland between 1986 and 2003. That's when Governor Jim Douglas selected him to be an associate justice on the Vermont Supreme Court. Then in December of 2004, Governor Douglas appointed Paul Reiber to be the Chief Justice of the court. Now, unlike judges on the U.S. Supreme Court who serve lifetime appointments, all judges in Vermont, including members of the Supreme Court, serve six-year terms and they're subject to retention review hearings by the legislature if they choose to serve another term on the bench. And since his original appointment, Justice Reiber has been overwhelmingly supported by these retention votes at the Statehouse. A lot of big issues that I wanted to discuss with you today, but maybe more on a personal note. You know, sometimes when people get appointed to the Vermont Supreme Court, they've previously served on a lower court. In your case, you went right from private practice to the Vermont Supreme Court. What are the pros and cons of having prior judicial experience before serving on the Supreme Court?
Well, let me start by amending my resume just with one thing, if I might, before we dive into that. I was town moderator in my small town of Chittenden in Rutland County for almost 20 years before Governor Douglas appointed me. That and some other experience I had serving on boards and committees involved with the courts and with the profession, with the Bar Association, piqued my interest. I served on the Judicial Nominating Board for 6 years. I was an elected representative of the bar under our system. The bar has three seats on an 11-member board, and I sat in one of those seats for 6 years. What I would tell you about coming on the court with that sort of background of experience and without sitting on the trial court is a very different eye-opening thing where I can tell you I thought I understood the system completely, having practiced law for almost 30 years in the courts, in virtually every court in the state. I found when I got to Montpelier that there were many, many things that I did not know about that exist behind the scenes. It's an interesting transition from private practice into government. But I'll say this as well. One of the things that I found through some of the service that I was involved in before I came on the court was the importance of public service. And I will tell you, Bob, that is a tremendous thing for anyone who has any interest in serving in a public service job like this one.
So what were some of the big surprises when you got on the court?
Well, I'll tell you a story. The Supreme Court has an administrative meeting scheduled every month. So every month we sit around a table on the third floor in a conference room, and we have an agenda, and we work through the agenda. And the agenda, this doesn't deal with decision-making. Of course, I'm sure, understand, and your listeners as well, the Supreme Court wears two hats. We make decisions in cases of appeals that have been filed. That's one hat. But we also, under the Constitution, have administrative responsibility for all of the courts in the state. The system, judicial branch, has about 400 employees. We have courts throughout all 14 counties. We have a budget of about $40 million. So the court has a tremendous amount of responsibility that it needs to discharge as a policymaking body relative to the administrative aspect of the job that we do. And so the story I was going to tell you is I remember sitting in an administrative meeting, and back in those days, a great, great judge, Frank McCaffrey from Rutland, who incidentally still serves on a volunteer basis as our judge in the drug court in Rutland. He's a wonderful, wonderful fellow, and he's a friend of mine. But Judge McCaffrey at that time was serving as the chief administrative trial judge, a position that Judge Brian Grierson now holds. And I remember the discussion was about something, and I can't remember the topic, but Judge McCaffrey said, well, you know, the problem is framed by the nuances of the culture that exists in the different courts in the different counties in the state. And I said, well, what are you talking about, culture? Because so far as I was concerned, the culture was consistent throughout the state. Every court I went to, I'd see many of the same lawyers. I'd see many of the same judges. But I began to learn at that point that we have a system that's very, very it has grown up. Our court system has grown up as a fellow named Michael Benger has written in a great law review article that was published a couple of years ago in the Kentucky Law Journal. And he talked in that article about how the courts in this country, it's not just this state, it's across the land, really began in the 18th century. And when they started, they grew up very localized in communities that supported them, that provided resources, but also that dealt with the cases. And in fact, even in those days, the Vermont Supreme Court did not sit in Montpelier. It traveled throughout the state, going to the individual counties to hear appeals. So we have an organic system, if you will, that grew up in a very balkanized fashion, if you will. Farther and farther we get down the road with the increase in case filings, with the increase in complexity of the cases and the suits that are filed, we need to establish management practices that apply equally across the state. But this is still very much a part of our challenge in managing the system.
You've been Chief Justice since 2004. Yeah. Have your responsibilities, have your duties, has your job description changed very much during that last decade?
No, I would say not. What I've always said about my job is it's what I make out of it. There's no special imprimatur in the Constitution with respect to responsibilities, duties, and obligations. I mean, there are a few very minor things in some of the laws that I do, but a very incidental. It really is a job that you embrace and take on the challenges and you work hard to deal with them.
We did get this email from Robert, who would like you to address this issue. Robert wrote us, "It's been widely reported that federal immigration officials are watching Vermont courthouses and making targeted arrests of undocumented workers when these individuals come into the courthouse for official business. There are stories of this happening outside of the Burlington Courthouse and also the courthouse in White River Junction." Robert sent us an article quoting the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the state of Washington, Mary Fairhurst, who wrote that these developments, quote, "are deeply troubling because they impede the fundamental mission of the courts." And in a letter to federal immigration officials, Justice Fairhurst asked them to stop this practice. Robert wrote us, "It is my hope that you could give similar guidance and direction in these times." What do you make of this situation?
I think that it's a very it's a serious problem. And I would one of the things I would like your listeners to know, and Robert in particular, is that back in April, I sent a memo to all of the employees inside our judicial branch. And Bob, I'd like to provide you with a copy of that memo, and feel free to publish it on the website. It was not released through a public service announcement or a press release of any sort. But I have it here in front of me. It went to every one of our employees, and if it's all right, I'd like to read from some of it. Would that be okay?
Sure, sure, absolutely.
All right. It's dated April 7. It's, as I say, to the entire branch. And it starts out, recent events have raised concerns among court staff about the potential impact of federal immigration enforcement efforts on our core mission. We are all, of course, aware of the ongoing public controversy over federal immigration policy. My purpose here is not to address or debate that policy. The goal here is much simpler but no less urgent. It is to affirm that the Vermont Judicial Branch remains fully committed to ensuring that every person who lives and works in the state of Vermont retains the right to free and unfettered access to justice under the law. It's a principle enshrined in the Constitution, as it is in the hearts and minds of inhabitants, that all stand equal before the law and are equally entitled to its benefits and protections as they are punishable for its violation. And that's a part of it. It goes on from there, and I'd be happy to refer to other specific provisions. In fact, it cites, the memo cites to a specific provision in the Constitution that provides, quotes, every person within this state ought to find a certain remedy by having recourse to our laws for all injuries and wrongs, and that, quotes, every person ought to obtain that right freely, completely, and without denial. And I received a number of very positive responses, I should tell you, from folks within the judiciary. My concern was that our folks were not being put in a position where it compromises their charge. And our charge, their charge is our charge, which is to serve the people of Vermont. The Constitution doesn't say only certain people should our courts be available to. The Constitution says every person, and that's the point that I was making with the memo.
So if you were an undocumented worker and you had some official business in a Vermont courthouse, how does that memo protect you?
Well, the point is that the people inside the courthouse who provide the service to undocumented immigrants as others, every other person, will provide exactly the same service. They will not be engaged in making some sort of a determination as to whether or not our services are available or not. And in fact, I'll tell you this too. I was in Philadelphia a couple weeks ago at the annual meeting of the Conference of Chief Justices, and we had a committee meeting about this specific issue that was very well attended and included a representative from ICE in Washington. I asked him specifically during that meeting, does ICE have a policy that requires their officers to gain the cooperation of court staff and court employees in any specific state jurisdiction? And more so, would he be against a policy that instructs his officers against inviting the cooperation of court staff and employees? Now, I had a conversation with him about that. Many other people in the room had conversations about similar issues. We, in fact, at the conference have a task force that has been convened to deal with ICE in Washington and to come to a meeting of the minds, I hope, with respect to a protocol that ICE will adopt with respect to how its agents conduct their business in and around our courts.
Would you like to, or have you, discouraged immigration officials from using this policy?
That's not the purpose of my memo. You know, we have public space. That's what courthouses are. They're public space. It is not within our province to stand in the way of anybody coming into that public space. So my concern is that anyone who uses the public space, if their intent is to use the public space for some purpose, that they, if that it not be an impediment to the availability of judicial services to every single person who seeks to avail themselves of those services.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Harlan, who's calling from Hyde Park. Hey, Harlan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's on your mind today?
Hello, Chief Justice Rip Reiber.
Yes, sir. How are you?
My question is two parts. Do you think Vermont would be better served by having a second level of appeal, like in most states, which have a Supreme Court, which doesn't combine the functions of appellate court and Supreme Court? And two, is there a difference between the success on appeal in the Rocket Docket and appeals made before the full bank of judges? Thank you.
All right, Harlan, thank you very much. We should explain to our listeners that unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, which reviews cases and says, all right, we're going to take that one, but we're not going to take that one, all these appeals are heard by the Vermont Supreme Court. I was actually stunned when I learned that earlier this week. I was unaware of that, that in some form or fashion, you are going to hear all of them. Now, you do have something, I guess, called the Rocket Docket, where you take cases and you consider a lot of them in a short period of time. But what about Harlan's concerns?
So the backstory, as you're suggesting, is that we're not a cert court under our Constitution. We're not a court of certiorari. The U.S. Supreme Court is, which is why litigants, appellants have to gain permission to file and pursue their appeals in the U.S. Supreme Court. We don't our Constitution does not provide for that. So just as you're saying, Bob, every single case that comes to the court, that comes in the door, the court hears. Some time ago in the late 80s, when Justice John Dooley had first come on the court was suffering from a tremendous backlog. I actually, before John left, and I was sad to see him go. He's a great, great friend and was a great justice as well. But before he left, he came in my office one day with some old papers he found when he was cleaning out his desk. And one of the documents was many, many pages of the pending case. It was a pending case list, something we monitor and we keep track of on a very regular basis. And this was evidence, palpable evidence, of the kind of problem the court was suffering from. Back in those days, every case got a 60-minute hearing, 30 minutes aside, didn't matter the shape, the size, the whether or not the legal issues were novel, new questions that had never been answered before.
That was true for every case.
Every single case. And so John Dooley became the principal author of this new system that was adopted in the early 90s called the Rocket Docket. And the system principally is one that is intended to establish sort of an intermediate court of appeal, as Harlan, the caller, was referencing, because what we do is we have circulation memos that are attached to every single appeal that comes in. This is virtually how it works. The circulation memos go to each justice on the court, and we all vote on whether or not the individual appeal that has been filed either raises a novel question of law that has never been answered before or is not black letter in the statutes of the Constitution, or is a very complex case, or perhaps with a very high profile that needs a full court review. And once we jury the cases in that way, a certain number of them are siphoned off into the so-called rocket docket, where and the other question that Harlan raised was, what's the what is the difference in success rate? Well, I think it would be quite clear if you did a study on this that the rate of affirming lower court decisions on the rocket docket is quite high. I think that's probably very true.
Do you think it's good to continue with this system, or Harlan suggested maybe some other sort of lesser appellate court?
I will tell you, you referenced my background before. The other thing that you didn't mention, Bob, was that I was not an appellate lawyer. And I told the Judicial Nominating Board this, as a matter of fact, when I interviewed. I said, if you're looking for an appellate lawyer, it ain't me. So I came to the court with a great deal of skepticism about the rocket docket. I really wondered whether or not people's rights were being adequately protected. I have to tell you that I think it's a very sound system. In fact, it's a system that wound up being adopted by several other small state appellate jurisdictions like ours. New Hampshire, I think, adopted one after us. Maine did as well. Rhode Island did. These are all states without an intermediate level of appeal.
A couple of years ago, Justice Reiber, you made an appearance in front of a joint session of the legislature where you warned that proposed budget cuts could have a very negative impact on the availability of justice in Vermont. And at that time, most courts, I think, were closed 2 or 2.5 days a month. What's the status of this situation today? Does the Vermont judicial system have the financial resources that it needs to ensure access to justice for all Vermonters?
You know, the budget cuts that we faced back then under the law, the executive branch is empowered through the Secretary of Administration to impose rescissions on our budget if the revenue shortfall is in excess of 1% during a given fiscal year. And we had faced back in those days, and this was after the financial collapse, a number of repeated rescissions, and we were forced to essentially close courts, as you say, and it was 2.5 days a week. We held positions open as well as retirement and departures occurred in order to save money. And it was a very, very tough time. It was in this time, incidentally, that we sought the approval of our friends in the legislature to restructure the court system, to try to bring some greater management flexibility to how we were allocating resources against demand. And since then, I could not say how grateful I am to folks in the executive branch, governor's office, finance, as well as in the appropriations committees and the bodies in the House and the Senate. Our requests, the information we provided, have been seriously considered, and we are so very grateful for that. So our situation today is much, much better. There's no question about that for all those reasons that I've just referenced. However, I would say this too. One of the things about court services and the obligation the state has, I would point out under the Constitution to provide access to the courts to everyone who lives in the state. One of the stresses that happens is that the courts wind up as a place where the problems in local communities become very manifest, very, very clear. And right now, to our notwithstanding, I should say, the great efforts of the judges and the staff and the efforts of folks in the other branches, we are facing a huge increase in child protection cases in Vermont. Anecdotally, this is related to addiction. I can tell you, as recently as this spring and early summer, I sat in a juvenile court a number of times in one of the counties in the state and witnessed these problems myself. These are, in one case, I could tell you about parents who both suffering from heroin addiction, have a little boy, been taken out of the house back in December. The state was trying to reconnect the child with the parents. The child had been in two or three foster homes. The parents were suffering mightily with addiction. You could see it in their faces in the courtroom. It's heartrending. And I don't know where that case stands today, but I can tell you that that is just one example of many, many, many other cases like this, and it's a very serious problem that we have on our hands right now. So are there enough resources? We are struggling with this problem, I would tell you, Bob, and it's not just money. It's resources. It's human resources. It is a broad range of things that we're working on.
Let's turn to Ben in Stowe, who wants to continue a discussion on this topic. Hey, Ben, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me, and thank you to Justice Rabbit for giving us the time to talk to you.
My question piggybacks
on that a bit, where talking about resources financially and human capital as well. I was wondering what your thoughts were on the establishment of drug courts in this state, given the opiate epidemic and also being conscious of our limitations financially and personnel-wise as well.
Okay.
And could you tell us, drug courts, what's the concept behind the drug court?
Well, the concept is a short leash. It's a leash that's connected to the court, to a judge who has the power to put an offender in jail if they fall off the wagon. To give you an example, I was in the Rutland Drug Court with Judge McCaffrey a couple years ago. Young woman, these are public proceedings, incidentally. These are adults. These are public proceedings. Young woman came up to the microphone, and the judge talked about how she had, and this is in front of other offenders who are sitting waiting their turn, talked about how she had dirty urine screens repeatedly over the past several weeks, had not shown up for the commitments that she had made with probation. She had not participated in trying to find housing and work and these other things, and had repeatedly failed to do so. And the judge said, you know, I've decided we've got to put you in jail for a couple of days, whereupon the sheriff walked over from the side of the room, put her in shackles, wrists and ankles, and she broke down in tears, and he let her out the back door. Now, this is in front of all the other drug offenders, folks that are having problems with addiction in the back of the room. So you can see that the concept is behavioral modification with a very, very strong incentive, and that being that that you go to jail if you don't comply. This is a huge impact on resources. Let me say that to you, and it is one that we, the courts, cannot afford to do on our own. So our policy position, and I think it's well considered, is that we will support a drug court if the local community and the people who are leaders in that community, including the local judge, and most importantly, including the local prosecutor, come to us. We actually have forms that we have provided throughout the state that folks can use for this purpose. And they come to us and say, look, we found a funding, grant funding from one source or another. We have the commitment of the prosecutor, of the defender, the court. and social services, most importantly social services. These are courts, I should call them dockets because they're not edifices. They're dockets within existing courts. These dockets are ones that can only work if you have a strong attention to the best practices that are accepted by everybody, and you've got local services. That's the most important part of it.
And this is an issue that you spoke out about very strongly 4 years ago, where you saw opiate addiction hitting the state of Vermont and came to the conclusion that locking everybody up was not the ultimate solution?
Well, I gave a speech in Boston to the National, New England Association of Drug Court Professionals, and in the speech, which I distributed to the legislature and the governor when I got back, basically what I said was that the classic criminal justice model from Jeremy Bentham in the 18th century, I think it is, the philosopher, the classic model is punish and deter. And the problem with addiction and criminogenic behavior related to addiction is that that is a model that that really doesn't work very well. That's the speech I gave you. Yeah.
Well, our guest today is the Chief Justice of the Vermont Supreme Court, Paul Reiber. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Jay, who is calling from Chelsea. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Yes. Thank you, Bob and Justice Reiber. Yes. My question is, what does the Vermont court system do to try and level the playing field when you have two parties engaged in a civil lawsuit and one of the parties is able to write off all their legal expenses due to the tax code and the other party does not have that type of resources to be able to write off their legal expenses? There seems to be quite a disadvantage there. I'm wondering what the Vermont court system does to try and alleviate that unfair playing field. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the question. Of course, the premise of your question that the courts provide a leveling of the playing field between parties is very, very important, and you're absolutely right about that. That is a fundamental concept that even the government, this is the metaphor I refer to frequently when we talk about this, even the government can lose in its own courts. That is the principle that's at stake with courts. The little guy, his interests, her interests are just as important and are protected the same way. Now, with respect to the expenses of litigation, I'm not sure what tax law you're talking about, and I'm probably not qualified to get into that at all anyway. I will say this. What your question reminds me of is that we follow the American system, a system where the individuals, unless there's a specific provision in the law contrary to this, individuals pay their own expenses of litigation in a civil lawsuit. That is the principle that we follow, it is one that's been tested and tried, and it is in the existing law right now.
Jay, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to Alex, who is calling from Montreal. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. First-time caller.
Hey, it's great to have you.
Thank you, sir. I just wanted to comment with all due respect to the guest that you have on. I just want to, you know, I want to bring to light the fact that we continue to speak about criminal convictions in situations with people who have addictions, and clearly, if I may, you know, these are not really standards and practices, I believe, that should be tried as criminal charges. I mean, while I understand that these, you know, these substances are illegal, clearly when people become addicted, they fall under the bracket of having physically abused or psychologically abused a substance which they feel they need. How can we be punishing people who are maybe beyond their means to help themselves? Shouldn't we be expanding medical health research programs and outreach programs? Shouldn't we be looking at maybe creating government-subsidized, actually providing a supply for these people so that we know exactly who is using, who is abusing. We can track it, and we can create a more, you know, constructive society rather than continuously putting people in jail and slapping on the wrist the people that do not respect our laws. I mean, maybe it's time as a society that we look at a more productive solution. What do you think?
All right, Alex, thanks very much for your phone call. Would you say that some of Alex's concerns are incorporated in the philosophy behind the drug courts?
Yeah, I think that's right. The notion is that people who suffer from addiction and commit certain kinds of crimes and have the consent of the prosecutor, the defender, and the services are available, the notion is that these are people that need help with the addiction and that we need to address that in order to reduce recidivism, which I think is a significant problem in our state.
Let's talk to Jed, who's calling from Rutland. Hey, Jed, what's on your mind today?
All right, this is more of a comment, I guess. I was calling about DUI laws, and I know this isn't just a Vermont thing, and I know the courts have ruled in this, but it seems like people's rights are really being violated. We've got this arbitrary .08. I'm not sure what that is supposed to prove. There's a civil and a criminal aspect to these laws. A lot of people don't know that. I think the whole thing where you're basically punished if you don't give evidence against yourself. We have some Fourth and Fifth Amendment issues here. Seems like an awful lot of people are pulled over for not doing anything indicative of drunk driving, just having a taillight out or something like that. The evidentiary test is an hour, could be up to an hour after you're pulled over. It just seems like I could go on and on, but it seems like there's a lot of ways where people's rights are being violated, and just would like to hear the judge's response, please.
All right, Jed, thanks for your phone call.
Well, thanks for the question. We certainly have, I think, witnessed in this state the problems incident to, you know, driving in compromised states. And the legislature has wrestled with that problem, trying to establish statutes and processes that are appropriate in place. I think your points are points that are frequently raised in litigation around this, and I certainly understand the position that you're talking about.
Justice Reiber, you know, some states elect their Supreme Court justices. I was doing some research on that, and in some states, even after being appointed by the governor, after a year, the justices actually face voter retention from everybody in the entire state. It's not an election as such, but do you approve of this person staying on the bench? So you really have two different systems there, electing them directly, which they go out and campaign, they raise money. What do you think of the idea of electing Supreme Court justices? And do you think Vermont has the sort of the best approach to this, where people apply for it, the governor makes a decision, and then we have a judicial retention process?
I think we have a very good process. And historically, our Constitution adopted this process in the 70s when this state's Constitution was amended in that respect, and many, many other states around the country, sort of in the shadow of Watergate, I think, is how it happened. And in fact, prior to the amendment of our Constitution, judges in this state were elected by a session of the legislature. And it's interesting to contemplate the difference between that system and the current one that we have. I think under the current one, it's a very, very good system. It's one that is populated, as I said before, by members of the bar, by appointed members from the legislature. There are six. And by two appointments that the governor has. Interestingly enough, unlike some other jurisdictions, the courts, the court itself has no seat on this board, either through an active judge or more appropriately probably through a retired judge. So that is one difference, I think, that could be made. But the notion of electing judges, I think, is a very tough sled. You know, there. I have friends in jurisdictions around the country who stand for election, have to raise and campaign for funds. It's a system where I think there are potential problems with the appearance, at least, of bias on the part of judges after they've been seated.
Let's get a quick call in from Dave, who is calling from Wilmington. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
And what's on your mind today, Dave?
Well, I heard talk about imprisoning drug offenders for having dirty urines. I'm a parent of a child who died in the phony war on drugs. And imprisoning someone just because they have a dirty urine who's basically otherwise a non-criminal is counterproductive. It's insanity. It's ridiculous. And there's no reason for it. This is a medical issue. It is not a legal issue. And I don't think these people even belong in courts. Courts are for criminals, not for people who are sick from addiction.
Dave, we appreciate your phone call, and we're very sorry for your loss. And again, Justice Reiber, I guess the whole drug court concept, we refer to it as drug court, but you probably refer to it as drug docket or something along those lines, yeah. Is trying to change that whole culture of punishment being the only answer.
You know, I let me join you in saying how sorry I am to hear, Dave, about your son. I it's a very tough thing that we are looking at where we see overdoses in the papers, sometimes daily, sometimes weekly. I think it's a real problem, and I wish there was a perfect solution to it. I think the drug courts are a solution. I don't mean to suggest that somebody who's simply addicted should go to jail, but that is one way in which the state is trying to address this problem right now.
And are we finding more counties deciding to open up this drug court docket?
Well, I think, you know, the focus that we've brought to it is to, as I said before, put the emphasis on local resources and the local population to decide what it is they can do and what it is they want to do. And I certainly look for more activity in that regard.
Well, we've all learned a great deal today about how Vermont's court system works and some of the challenges facing the court. Vermont Supreme Court Chief Justice Paul Reiber, many thanks for taking the time to talk to us today about these very important issues.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks very much.